For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, but this morning, we are going to be talking about what do you want? Right? Maybe something you've been thinking a lot this holiday season. But really, how much do we really think about this? The way that we answer this question, what do you want? It will determine much of what you do. Right? What are the desires, the underlying affections and commitments that are driving us? This is something that we want to think about this morning as we continue this study in 1 Corinthians. All right, so let's just read a little bit about what Paul has to say here. Do want to point this out first, though, and I think this is an image that you guys have seen as you've been going through the book of 1 Corinthians. So when we're talking about change, we're not just talking about changing external behaviors. In the book of 1 Corinthians, you find out the Corinthians were having some behavioral problems, right? That comes up quite a bit in this book. And what's interesting to note is that Paul doesn't just say, stop doing those bad things and start doing these good things, right? And that's a lot of the time how we think we ought to change our behavior. Instead, what we see Paul doing over and over again is he's saying, you need to think about what you're believing and what's underneath those wrong behaviors. What's the wisdom that you're buying into, the worldly perspective that you're embracing, those values, those beliefs? And you need to replace those with God's perspective. You need to buy into God's wisdom before that is going to result in any kind of real transformation or change. And this is going to be real important, too, as we talk about things like our desires and our cravings and what we want. I mean, have you ever tried to not want something that you want? It's kind of hard, pretty difficult, right? And so we want to learn how we got to go down on a level of what we're believing and what we're thinking and ask God to change those beliefs if we're going to see that kind of lasting transformation. So let's read what Paul has to say here. He says, for I do not want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers and sisters, that our ancestors were all under the cloud and that they all passed through the sea. What? Okay, this is what Paul's talking about here. He's saying, I'm going to tell you a little bit about these ancestors under the cloud and the sea. This would have been an immediate, oh yes, we know who you're talking about, unlike us, where we're like, what is he talking about? He's talking about the Exodus community. He's like, I have some things that I want to point out. There are some lessons for us to learn from the Exodus. Now, the Exodus, if you've ever seen the movie, The Ten Commandments, or The Prince of Egypt, you know, one of those. This is about a significant period of time in Israel's history where they were brought out of slavery in Egypt. God parted the Red Sea, brought them into the desert, and was leading them to this promised land. He said, you are no longer going to be slaves. You're going to be my people. I'm going to give you a land, your own nation. You're going to be free people. And really, the Exodus, as you read the Old Testament, it comes up over and over again. God is identified repeatedly as the God who brought you out of slavery in Egypt, the God who rescued you. And really, this becomes a symbol of salvation, right? This idea of being under the cloud. What is that? Well, as they exited Egypt, God led them, and he led them in the form of this pillar of smoke or this cloud. That during the day, you would just see the smoke, and at night, you would, you know, as it was dark out, you would see this pillar of fire. And you could really never tell when this thing was going to move or where it was going to go. So sometimes, you know, they would be hanging out at one point, even for a whole year, just waiting for God to lead them. You know, oftentimes it would move every other day or so. But this is really, you know, I want you to know, brothers and sisters, about our ancestors that were following God, who had been led by God out of slavery and passed through the Red Sea, right? And this is, again, a miraculous provision of the Lord bringing the people out of slavery and essentially rescuing them from the pursuant Egyptian army by actually parting the Red Sea. And this Red Sea, I mean, this isn't like a little puddle. It's not like a little creek. I mean, this is a serious sea, okay? Like, I've been there. It's massive, and this was miraculous, right? This is something supernatural that God did to provide for his people. And so he's going to tell, Paul says, I want you to know a few things about this community. And really what he's doing is he's going to point out, first and foremost, look at how God provided for them. Look at the things that God did for these people. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. Now, when we see this, we're like, what does this mean? When we think baptism, what do we think? We think water baptism, right? Where people, after coming into a relationship with Christ, allow themselves to be immersed in water as a symbol of this relationship they now have with God. And is that what he's talking about here? What does it mean to be baptized into Moses? Their word baptized just means to be immersed. Right? We naturally associate that with water, but that's not necessarily the association they would have made. What does it mean to be baptized into Moses? Well, this is language that Paul uses elsewhere in the New Testament to talk about us being baptized into Christ. In 1 Corinthians 12 and Romans 6, he uses that same phrase talking about being baptized into Christ. What does it mean to be baptized into Christ? Well, what the Bible teaches us is that when we come into a saving relationship with Jesus, when we say, I know, Lord, that my own moral performance will never be good enough for you, and that I have problems. I have sin. I have fallen short, and that needs payment, and I want Christ's death on the cross to count for me. Instead of having to approach God on the basis of our own good works, on our own good performance, we no longer do that, and we defer to Christ instead, so that when God sees us, instead of looking at us and evaluating us based on our own performance, we have been immersed or baptized in Christ. So what happens instead is there's Christ interceding for us on our behalf. Lord, you don't have to evaluate this person on the basis of what they've done or what they haven't done. You can evaluate them on the basis of what I've done. And it's really interesting, as you read through Exodus, you see Moses playing that same role for the Israelites over and over again. Specifically in an episode we'll look at here in a second, in Exodus 2, where they were practicing idol worship, and God was enraged by this. He was like, that is wrong. I'm upset about this. And Moses intervenes and says, yes, but these are the people that you've rescued. These are the people that you've brought out of salvation, or out of slavery and into salvation. These are your people. And he advocates for them, right? And that's a picture of what God does for us, or Christ does for us. And so what's happening here, as Paul is talking about these provisions that God made for this Exodus community, that Paul is reminding, through his language, he's reminding the Corinthians that God has given you the same provisions. And I think it's really important for us to notice here, as we get into some of the instructive language that Paul's going to have in a bit here, to notice that this is all starting with God's provision and what God has already done and already given us. So you guys were baptized into Moses. They all ate the same spiritual food. Okay, so this would be referring to the manna, which was this bread-like substance that God would provide every morning for the Israelites when they were in the desert. Basically, it's like waking up and having God make you breakfast, literally, right? Every day, there it is. And they could gather and eat it for the day, but it would spoil and they would have to go out and get it the next day. You know, so every day they're having to go back, trust the Lord to provide for them. And they drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Christ. And so literally, as they're out in the desert, when they would need water, God would just bring forth water from a rock. Just miracle, right there on the spot, providing the water to meet the needs. And of course, Jesus in the New Testament tells us what? He says, I'm the living water. Drink from me and you'll never be thirsty again. So Paul again is bringing up these parallels. Like, look at these miraculous ways that God provided for these people. He parted the Red Sea. He provided them with food every day, water out of a rock. He provided them with an intercessor, someone to advocate for them. And this is exactly what God's given you, Corinthians, too. So God had done all these amazing things for them. Nevertheless, God was not pleased with most of them. Their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. It's kind of amazing that even though God had given these people every resource they needed, provided for them time and time again, supernatural intervention after supernatural intervention. Many of them would not submit to him. Most of them. All but two of them, in fact. We read in Deuteronomy 1, okay, so normally it only takes 11 days to travel from Mount Sinai, right? So that's, they're out of Egypt. Moses goes up on the mountain. He gets all this instruction from God. So from that mountain to Kadesh Barnea, right? So the kind of border of the promised land where God was going to lead them. I'm going to give you your own country. You're going to be a people, be a nation. That should take 11 days. That's what this is telling us. Going by the way of Mount Seir. But 40 years after the Israelites left Egypt, on the first day of the 11th month, Moses addressed the people of Israel, telling them everything that the Lord had commanded him to say. So what are we saying here? We're saying that these people managed to stretch an 11-day journey, something that should have taken them about a week and a half, over 40 years. And in fact, only two of them, Joshua and Caleb, from this original generation, actually made it into this promised land. How does that happen? How do people that had seen God do some of the most amazing things that he had ever done in history, how did they say, I don't want to follow you? I'm not interested. I'm not happy with what you've given me, God. And because of that, missed out on this promised land. And when we're talking about the promised land here, as there's obviously all these parallels between the Christian life and this Exodus experience that Israel had, the promised land here is not signifying getting into heaven, right? Or gaining God's ultimate acceptance. Once you're in a relationship with Christ, that is a settled deal. Your standing before God will not change. But let's remember what the context of 1 Corinthians 10 is. Right, in 1 Corinthians 9, and I believe you talked about this last week, Paul spends all this time talking about, I become all things to all men, I'm doing whatever I can to further the gospel. And he says this, don't you realize that in a race, everyone runs, but only one person gets the prize. So run to win. All athletes are disciplined in their training. They do it to win a prize that will fade away, but we do it for an eternal prize. So I run with purpose in every step. I'm not just shadow boxing. I discipline my body like an athlete, training it to do what it should. Otherwise, I fear that after preaching to others, I myself might be disqualified. And you see, what is Paul talking about here? He's talking about being effective. He's talking about being faithful. He's talking about being fruitful. He's like, I have my heart set on living a life that is going to glorify God. So I'm running this race. That's what I'm doing. What do you want? Here are these two pictures that Paul is setting up next to one another. You can run this race. You can run for that prize. You can run with that purpose and with that drive. Or you can wander around a spiritual desert for 40 years. What is it going to be? And as he's presenting the Corinthians with these two pictures, he's going to expose some of these underlying heart attitudes that the Israelites had. And he's warning the Corinthians, don't give your heart to these things. Watch these cravings. Watch these desires. Be mindful of them so that you don't miss out, so that you don't waste your time wandering around aimlessly and thereby forfeit the race. Right, so this is some, and this is a good reminder and warning for us too. So we need to think about this. What is it that I want? What do I want my life to count for? What are the desires that are propelling me forward in my everyday life? That's what we want to think about, because, you know, why was God not pleased with these people? Why was he so upset with these people that he had provided for? He says, now these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil as they did. So they had set their hearts on evil, rather than setting their heart on God himself. They had set their heart on evil. In some versions, this is described as their cravings, their desires. And the word that's used there in the Greek, epithumia, it literally just means over desire. So these things, they're not always necessarily bad things. They're just things that we want more than God. Tim Keller says this. He says, it's not that I want something bad, but it's that I want it so badly. That I want it so badly. That this is something that I'm willing to sacrifice everything for, that I'll protect at all costs. The thing that I rest my joy in, where I find my peace, that I've allowed to take the place of God in my life. It's these cravings, it's setting their hearts on these things that led them to be displeasing to the Lord. And I think this is good, right? Because this really gets at the heart of it. It's not necessarily these external things going on in our lives that are the problem. The problem is, where do our affections lie? And that, and he's going to unearth these four different areas, which this became evident with the ancient Israelites. And he says, do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry. All right, so this is talking about Exodus 32. This is the example that I was talking about a little earlier where, you know, God has rescued the Israelites. He's brought them out of Egypt, brought them out of slavery. They have walked through the Red Sea. And Moses is taking his time up there with God. And people are starting to feel a little impatient. Is he going to come down? What are we supposed to do? Where are we going to go? What's going to happen? Starting to feel a little nervous here. And so they decide, take off their jewelry, melt it in the fire, have Aaron fashion it into the image of a golden calf, and we'll worship this. And Moses comes down, and he's horrified. And so is God, right? To see how quickly these people would turn to an idol. And, you know, you think about the Corinthians, and there's probably some of them that were tempted to return to idols, to return to false gods. And we think, how foolish. And yet, don't we do the same thing all the time? Anytime we elevate any person or anything over God in our lives, that's an idol. And these idols, they're not always bad things. You know, I have a one-year-old daughter. And she is pretty stinking cute. And I love her. And I could probably talk about her all the time. It just seems like a really fine line there, right? It'd be so easy to make her my God. So easy. And she's in my life for a reason. God's given me this wonderful role to be her mother. That's something that's good, that God wants me to do in a faithful way. But she can't be my God. You know, those of us here who are married, if we were to look at our spouse and say, you know, you're just not really cutting it. You're not meeting my needs the way I need them met. I've got this other person over here. I'm going to go to them to have my needs met. That's adultery, and that is wrong. It's wrong to turn to somebody else and allow them to take the position that only your spouse should fill in your life. And it is just as wrong when we turn to other things and allow them to take the place of God in our life. And God feels pretty strongly about that. Pretty strongly. The Bible describes him as a jealous God, you know, as a spouse with an unfaithful wife or husband would feel. It's a righteous jealousy. You belong to me. I can't stand to see you turning to these false gods, to these other lovers. Right? It disturbs him. And yet, if we're honest with ourselves, you know, it's like you look at Israel and you're like, are you serious? Did you not just walk through the Red Sea? And you just took off your own jewelry, and now you are worshiping that? Do you not realize you were wearing that as a bracelet, you know, earlier that morning?
How could you worship that and not God? And yet, I see the same thing in my heart all the time. I have a heart that is completely fickle. Right? One day, I am in tears, on my knees, amazed at how good God is and how he loves me. And I can't believe how much goodness he's brought into my life. And I'm just overwhelmed by who he is. And I think I would die for you. You know, I feel that way. And the next, I'm like, really? Really, I have to serve this person right now? Don't you think I've earned a little downtime? Don't you think I do enough for you the rest of the week? This is for me. This is my night. And all of a sudden, I become so protective of my own comfort that I'm not willing to hand it over at all. We have hearts that are extremely prone to idol worship. And as I was thinking about this, there were a couple of things that came to mind where I think throughout time, this is something that Christians wrestle with. It's something that, you know, the Corinthians wrestled with. It's something that the Israelites wrestled with. Maybe you've heard of this hymn before. You know, we don't maybe reflect on hymns too much every now and then around here, but this came to my mind, this Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing, and I will not sing it, but the lyrics here, I feel this. Bind my wandering heart to thee. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. My heart is prone. It is susceptible to find anything else to lay its affections on. Prone to leave this God that I love. Here's my heart, Lord, take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above. Or even in the 17th century poet John Donne, in one of his holy sonnets, says this. He says, take me to you, imprison me. For I, except you enthrall me, never shall be free, nor ever chaste, except you ravish me. So I read that and I was like, what does that mean? And then my husband helped me understand it, and it was helpful. He was like, because I was telling him about the hymn that I liked, and he was like, it's like this poem by John Donne. I was like, this does not make sense to me. But what is he saying there? He's saying, my heart is so prone to infidelity, it would never be chaste unless you, God, came and ravished it. Think of that image. It's like, we just, in the hymn before, we have to go to God, and we have to say, bind my heart to you. Come and imprison my heart. Like, this is what this poet is saying. Because I'm so easily willing to give that affection away. I think we, you know, I'm using these images because I think they put it pretty powerfully. We have to have a grasp on how easily our hearts drift from the Lord. And if you don't feel that tension, if you don't feel like you struggle with this, that would suggest that you've already fully given your heart over to some idol in your life. It could be your financial security. It could be a relationship. Could be the affirmation of other people. Like me, it could be the comfort in your life. Whatever it is it taking the place of the Lord? You should feel this tension. That's something that I think we need to be wrestling with and identifying. And I think all we can do is really call out to God and say, change this. And there's some other things that we can do as far as changing our perspective that we'll talk about later, but you can totally see why Paul would bring this up with the Corinthians. This would totally make them ineffective. People will know by your life what or who you're worshiping. They'll be able to tell. And Paul knew, you know, as people look at you, they're going to know, are you running this race? Do you have your heart set on that eternal prize? Or are you guarding it, saving it for this other idol that you have over here? So he calls on them to avoid this kind of idolatry. We should not commit sexual immorality, as some of them did. And in one day, 23,000 of them died. So this is talking about an episode in Numbers 25, where the Israelites once again disobeyed God and were involved in certain degree of sexual morality that also involved a sort of adoption of these pagan religious rituals that God had a major problem with. So this, again, was not just them ignoring his instructions for sexual morality, but also, once again, spiritual unfaithfulness on their part. And so they invited this plague upon them that ended up in a lot of them dying. And, you know, so we read this and we think, wow, that sounds really kind of harsh. Why is God bringing about all this, you know, discipline and judgment and whatnot? And really, as we read through the Old Testament, and especially God's dealing with Israel, it's important that we see that what's shocking is not God's discipline, not that God allowed for them to experience the consequences of their decisions. That's not what is so shocking. What is shocking is that time and time again, God reaches out, rescues, initiates, takes back, provides for these people that continually turn away from him. That is what is shocking. And in this case with sexual immorality, I believe you guys spoke about this was something you guys looked at a few weeks ago, because this comes up earlier in the book of 1 Corinthians. So I won't spend a ton of time on it, but suffice it to say that God is pretty clear that sexuality is something that he's given us and that he designed for the context of a marriage commitment where two people are into serving and giving to each other, and that that's something that they grow in together. And and he really has a problem when we decide that we're going to use our sexuality to take from other people and use their bodies for our own personal gratification. Something God has a problem with. And you can see once again how this would be something that would discredit you, that would disqualify you from that prize, from being effective and faithful and fruitful. And I think the area of sexuality is very clear to see where the epithymia, the over-desire, plays in there. How we take something that God intended for good and we elevate it and we twist it and we use it for our own desires. We should not test Christ as some of them did and were killed by snakes. So this is referring to an episode in Numbers 21 where once again the Israelites are turning on God. In fact, if you read the discourse there as they kind of bring their charges against God, it goes like this. They say, "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? Why did you rescue us from slavery anyway? For there is no food and no water, and we loathe this miserable food." So they're like, "There is no food, and we hate this food." Right? Again, it sounds funny, but we say it all the time, right? God, when are you going to provide for me? When are you going to give me what I need? And he says, "I have provided for you." And we say, "Not like that. That's not the provision I wanted. I want what I want, right? I want it to look like this. I want it to be this way." And we're totally dissatisfied with what the Lord's offering us. We totally minimize what he's done for us. It's easy to do. You know, as we read about Israel and we see these mistakes they make over and over again, it's so easy to be like, wow, these guys were really thick. But I think, you know, I see this in my life all the time, ignoring, forgetting over and over again how God has displayed his goodness and what he's given us. Right? Again, warning the Corinthians. Again, remember, it started with this picture of look at all God had done for them. Look at what God's done for you. Don't reject that and demand that God give you his provision how you want it. And do not grumble as some of them did and were killed by the destroying angel. So this episode that comes up in Numbers 16, this was a situation where these guys were like, "Moses and Aaron, what's so special about them? We can do this without them. Let's get rid of them." And they're trying to revolt against God's, the leaders that God had raised up and provided for them, and decided that they were competent and spiritual enough to lead on their own. And this kind of relates to the trying of the Lord, but it's that attitude of like, I don't like God's plan. I don't like this person that he's brought here. I don't like the situation that he's put me in, so I'm going to take matters into my own hand, and I'm going to deal with it. And God has a problem with that. I think what's underneath this grumbling heart, when we look at the circumstances, the situations that we're in, and we grumble, we complain, what's underneath that? That's, we start sounding like a six-year-old, right? Because it turns into, you don't love me, God. You never do anything for me. You don't care about me, right? And, you know, my daughter's just learning to talk, so we haven't had any of that yet, which is good. But, you know, as a parent, you know, you can imagine how much love you have for your child and for them to turn to you and say, you must not love me. You know, I mean, think about how that must make God feel. What are we saying? We're saying we're suspicious of him and we do not trust him. And his gifts are not good. Again, this coming from people who he had rescued, who he had performed all these supernatural interventions, the amazing things these people had seen, to have them grumble against him. And you think, really, I mean, does grumbling really belong in the same category as idolatry and sexual immorality? Is it really that bad? Everyone likes a little grumbling here and there. It's dangerous. Yes. Yes, it is dangerous. And this is the beginning of a lot of it. It's that kind of ungrateful attitude. In Romans 1, Paul says this, for although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. Right? So he's talking about a little different context here. He's talking about what's plain to all people. But he's saying, you know, that lack of thankfulness, that lack of honor for God, so they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. They exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator. With that lack of thankfulness, with that ungrateful, that grumbling heart, we really open ourselves up to all these other idols, all these other desires, these places where we can set our hearts apart from God. Because we're saying, what you've offered me is not enough. And it's not good enough. And so it's kind of interesting to look here how Paul kind of talks about these things that maybe are a little more outward, like, you know, worshiping the golden calf, worshiping an idol, sexual immorality, you know, but really gets at, this is the attitude that underscores all of this. You don't wake up one day and decide, I think I'll worship my career. I think that's what I'll do. That's probably where all my happiness will come from. You know, that doesn't happen in one day. I think I'll run out on my spouse. I think I'll get involved in some kind of sex affair of some sort. You know, that's not what happens. It's this attitude that we give into day after day that eventually leads us to places where we're like, yeah, God, you haven't given me what I needed, and I'm going to get it somewhere else. So we have to be watchful of this. These things happen to them as examples, and were written down as warnings to us, on whom the culmination of the ages has come. Again, Paul reminding them, you learn from this. Don't just look at the Israelites and be like, wow, they were dumb. We need to look at them and be like, this tells me something about my own heart and about the dangers that I could face. And so if at this point you're thinking, okay, right, be totally committed to God, that's right, sounds good, I've heard this rap before, yada, 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 run the race, good, good. Maybe you should think about this. So if you think you are standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. We need to be really suspicious of our own spiritual pride and arrogance. I mean, are we sitting here this morning thinking, I'm totally committed. No idols in my life anywhere. Never been ungrateful ever. Well, I would like to meet you and shake your hand and say congratulations, right? That's not how it is. That's not the picture we get. This is something that that's not the image we get in the New Testament. You know, Paul himself talks about his own struggles, striving for what's ahead. This is a struggle. We need to be suspicious of our own hearts and to have a healthy inquiry and examine ourselves and ask God to show us, where am I at? I think that would be a great prayer this morning. I think one of the hardest things is just to really be honest with yourself about where your heart is with the Lord and where have your affections been. I think that'd be, you know, if you are tempted to give into this kind of thinking, if I have this all together, that would be a great prayer for you. But I know that a lot of us also maybe are sitting here feeling like, I'm too messed up. I have way too many problems. I'm probably just going to spend the rest of my life wandering around some kind of desert. And God probably won't use me. And it's probably hopeless. I'm never going to sort through all this junk in my life. We need to remember that he says this too. No temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so you can endure it. As we look at these longings in our life that lead us away from God, we have to remember that he is there calling out to us, drawing us back to himself all the time. This is what's really cool. This passage started with what? This list of provision, right? This list of provision, these things that God has done. And what is it ending with? A reminder that even when we're struggling, he will then provide again. He's always there, always ready to take us back if we're ready to turn to him. And I think this is good because you can look at these things and be like, okay, no idols, no sexual immorality, no trying the Lord, no grumbling. How am I going to do all this? The point is, how are you going to respond to God's provision? That's what the Israelites didn't do. That though God had provided them for them, they rejected God's provision. It's not about being tough enough. It's not about being spiritual enough. It's not about being smart enough or good enough, being able to perform well enough. It's about responding to what God has done. That's what we need to do. And, you know, this is an example to us. There's something to learn here. There is the danger of having your spiritual life be that of a desert, that you wander around aimlessly. But we got to think, what do we want? Is that what we want? Do we want to just repeat and relive what the Exodus community went through? Or do we want to run that race? Like Paul talked about in 1 Corinthians 9, do we want to have our lives count? Is what I really want just a little more peace and quiet, a little more me time, a little bigger 401k? Is what I really want for my spouse to leave me alone and stop bothering me all the time? For my boss to finally give me the recognition that I've always wanted? Are those things going to give us a full and abundant life? No. Do I want to let God transform me? Do I want to let him enable me to run this race? That's what we need to think about. And again, this is not about just doing the right thing. All right, we need that wisdom of God that we were talking about at the beginning there. We need to get our mindset on what does he say is important? Because again, how am I just going to change the things that I want? How do I just change those desires? How do I make it so my heart isn't set on these evil things? How do I change that? Again, let's think back to what Paul was saying there in 1 Corinthians 9. I think this is great. Don't you realize that in a race, everyone runs, but only one person gets the prize? So run to win. This is not just aimlessly wandering around the desert. I'm running to win. I know what I'm after. All athletes are disciplined in their training. They do it to win a prize that will fade away, but we do it for an eternal prize. Think about all these things, all right? I want to worship the idol. We don't know what Moses is doing. We're confused. We need answers now, right? I don't know if God's going to provide for me, so I'm going to turn to my idol of choice to get what I need now. God's got this design for sexuality. I want my needs met now, my way. God's given me this provision. It's not what I want right now. We're all about the now. And we've lost sight of that eternal prize. All right? But this is really interesting to read the New Testament authors and see how often they talk about eternity. They just couldn't stop talking about it. They were so excited about it. They lived every day like it was real. Paul's like, I'm not doing this for my health. I'm doing this because my God is going to look at me and say, well done, good and faithful servant. That's what kept him in the race. He says, so I run with purpose in every step. I'm not just shadow boxing. I'm not wandering around some desert, avoiding the life that God has for me. I discipline my body like an athlete, training it to do what it should. Literally, what he's saying there is, I take my body and I lead it around and I make it do what I want it to do. I'm not just a victim of my own appetites and cravings. Right? I have my mindset. I have a resolve and an abandonment to God. And I'm not going to let these feelings and these cravings and these desires and temptations disqualify me. Otherwise, I fear that after preaching to others, I myself might be disqualified. He's like, I am not going to miss out. Yeah, Paul had these same struggles. He talks about that openly in Romans 7. He knows what it's like to wrestle. But he's like, I'm not going to let those desires disqualify me from experiencing this life and that eternal prize for living for what really matters. That's what he had his heart set on. And so we can think about these two pictures, these two images, these two ways of living that Paul has set forth here to the Corinthians. You know, there's this image of the heart set on evil. And in this case, we're thinking about what feels good. What's going to bring me pleasure? What's going to satisfy my needs in the way I want them satisfied? We think about present circumstances, right? That whole the urgency of the now and the here and what's going on today and needing to deal with my temporal circumstances first and foremost. That's what becomes urgent. And because of that, we're just directed by our desires and we become spiritually aimless, wandering around, self-indulgent, right? If what is directing our life, if what's leading our life is our heart desires, these cravings, then of course we're going to indulge at every opportunity we have. And the result is this wasteful wandering. How many years will go by and we wonder, what has God even done? Have I changed in the last 10 years? Have I changed in the last 20 years? That's not someone that's experiencing the race that Paul's describing there. Living for the prize. I'm willing to suffer. Look, I know that there's going to be hardship. Paul says, I'm going to discipline my body. I'm going to make it do what I want it to. Again, focused on that eternal prize, driving him all the way, knowing what he's running towards. If you don't know what you're going towards, the whole race seems pretty pointless. You know, with that resolve, that purpose in every step, just abandoned to God. Sold out to him, knowing that following him, that he's going to get me there. Now you think about, again, this Exodus community, how basically they all were like, yeah, we can't go into this promised land. That's crazy. That seems really hard. Let's just hang out in the desert, right? And then let's go back to Egypt. Why would we go into this promised land? These two guys were like, are you crazy? This is God. This is the God that brought us out of slavery, brought us through the Red Sea. We are going. And you know what? They ended up having to kind of wait for that because of everybody else. But they got there. They got there. They abandoned themselves to the Lord, and they got to see what that faithful fruitfulness brought forth in their life. And so
Just in closing here, I thought I'd share a little quote from John Piper, because, you know, Piper, he just right to the point. He has a way with words, and I thought it kind of wrapped this up. And this is from his book, Don't Waste Your Life. He says, the path of God-exalting joy will cost you your life. Jesus said, whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospels will save it. In other words, it is better for you to lose your life than to waste it. If you live gladly to make others glad in God, your life will be hard, your risks will be high, and your joy will be full. It is not about how to avoid a wounded life, but how to avoid a wasted life. Some of you will die in the service of Christ. That will not be a tragedy. Treasuring life above Christ is a tragedy. So I thought, you know, that gives you some perspective there. What am I worried is going to happen? Am I worried that I'm going to suffer? Am I worried that I'm going to be wounded? Or am I worried that this opportunity to live a life of faith is going to be wasted? Cool. Well,
this study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.